Welcome to the Psychology World podcast. I'm Connor Whiteley, bringing you the psychology news, articles, and other interesting psychology-related articles. You can find the podcast notes and more interesting psychology-related things, and you can get your free 8 psychology book box set at connorwhiteley.net. Now let's get on to the show. Hi everyone and welcome to episode 104 of Psychology World Podcast with me, Con Wiley, and today's episode is on how to know if your therapist is a match to you. So even though the title is very much aimed at our clients in a clinical psychology, this episode is actually more aimed towards clinical psychologists and university psychology students. So in case you've found this episode by thinking that this was specifically designed for clients and people going to therapy, I'm sorry, but you will actually still find this useful. So this is a great episode. This is actually one of my favourite episodes in quite a while because I was really energised as I was writing the blog post. I really am looking forward to today's episode. And it is Friday the 30th of July 2021 as I record this. So moving on to the psychology news section, we're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest. And I haven't had a chance to look at these posts yet. So, social media posts that are hostile towards political opponents get more shares. What makes something go viral online? A lot of work has highlighted the role of emotion. Social media posts that express strong emotions, and particularly negative emotions, tend to get spread further. Well, I know what I'm going wrong then on social media. Now, a study has identified another factor that seems to have an even greater effect on how often posts are shared. The team finds that tweets and Facebook posts that contain more language referring to political opponents get more shares. These posts may be so popular, they suggest, because they appeal to feelings of anger and outrage towards the political out group. Well, I think that just like sums up where we're all going wrong with social media. No, well, but joking aside, I really do understand this, and to be honest, you really don't have to look too far to like see this. Well, this is why a lot of social media platforms have actually gone quite horrible in the last few years, mainly since the 2016 US election, mainly like because of Facebook, like nowadays, from at least like what I hear, lots of people tend to stay away from singles. It's so political. And Twitter I tend to use a lot more, and is a lot better. And the mind, there's the Something Mind report from the late 2010s, which does say that Twitter is the best social media platform for like mental health because it's the least damaging. But yeah, but this is like definitely true. I'm not sure where I was going like with this, but yes, but this is like a sad truth that we live in very politically divided times and very hostile times if you're politically active. No idea where that was going. So we're moving on to the next one. Some teenagers at risk of self-harming can be identified a decade in advance. And I've got to add this to the reflection list because I did see this in passing. So there are multiple risk factors for self-harm, including history of abuse, trauma, physical and mental illness, and bullying. Identifying these factors is the key part of prevention, ensuring that those at risk will receive appropriate support as early as possible. But despite this, predicting who may end up engaging in self-harm behaviour is still tricky. But we may be able to identify these risks earlier than we thought. New research finds that some at-risk adolescents could be identified 10 years earlier before they self-harm. Often, what the team says is an extended window during which help and support can be offered. Personally, I think that would be very nice if there was more support, and this is very upsetting topic, and I really have been wanting to do podcast episodes on self-harm and the sort of darker side of a mental health, but also I really don't know because there's just a lot of stuff with it. So I don't know, really. I think it's just important to note. And if anyone, and to be honest, in a clinical psychology, we are very likely to encounter people who have or have been self-harmed in the past. So yes, and I think this is just something that we need to be aware of. So we're moving on to the next one. During lockdown, couples were happiest when they blamed the pandemic for their stress. Well, that's a very good one, actually. During the pandemic, many of us were locked down with little face-to-face contact with anyone well, with anybody other than our partners. Considering the stress of the time and the intensity and the intensely close quarters we were in, you would be forgiven for thinking that this was a recipe for serious tension. And come on, I think we all know that it would. I think we all know that if two people are like trapped together for too long, there's going to be arguments, there's going to be fights. So yes, I would definitely think that. A new study, however, suggests that the reality might not be so cut and dry. The researchers found that the pandemic actually played an important part in people's abilities to deal with stress. When couples blamed their stress levels on the pandemic, they were happier in their relationship. And this reminds me of something I spoke about in my Psychology of Relationships book. In the communication chapter, it was something in the attribution style. Well, what you do is that if you blame the negatives on external factors but the good things on internal factors, then that's supposed to make your relationship really strong. And that's not an official tip, but you might want to try that in relationships. And that was the last one. So that's enough psychology news section. So let's move on to the personal update. But that relationship tip I do still really like. So we're moving on to the personal update. So this week, in all honesty, this personal update will be very short, simply because I've been doing tons of stuff. I've actually been rushed off my feet, but none of it's psychology related. It's mainly been author writing that. Well, bits that I'm actually not going to go into too much depth about that, except what I will mention. Well, yes, I'll mention like three things. So first of all, I'm continuing to chip away at the police psychology book, and I'm now on the section about interviewing and like a police interviewing and what's the psychology way to actually interview someone. To make sure that they remember correctly, that you reduce false memories and all of the other memory biases that I talk about in my cognitive psychology book. Yes, that's really interesting. And to be honest, I had no idea there were so many different ways like to interview with people. So I'm really enjoying like that section. I think I'm done researching that section in a few pages time. And then we get on to the very interesting topic of police brutality and lethal force. Of course, I really am looking forward to that because it's such a contemporary topic. And then the other thing, though, is that I'm very happy to say that I can actually get my second vaccination a week earlier because the NHS has like emailed me. So I will now be getting my second vaccination at the beginning of September. I think it's Friday the 3rd, though. And of course, like, it goes like without saying, but please get your vaccine. Just please. Yeah, so like, just please do it. Keep yourself safe. Please just keep everyone safe. And then the last one is that finally a clinical psychology reflection book that I've been talking about is actually available on a pre-order, and I've actually finished up the second one that's actually be available on a pre-order in the next month or so. So I can actually give you like the full title too, like in a case you want to pre-order it. So it's called Clinical Psychology Reflections, Thoughts on Psychotherapy, Mental Health and Abnormal Psychology and More. So I'm actually really, really glad to actually have this book out because it's filled with all my fact-based opinions on clinical psychology, and it's really written in a way that both university psychology students can actually really enjoy it, but also so can a clinical psychologist. I really do recommend checking out that book. And actually, that's it for the personal update. So as always, I always like love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can always email me, connorwhiteley@connorwhiteley.net. You can always leave a comment on the show notes at ConnorWhiteley.net/podcast, and you can also tweet me on Twitter @SciFiWhiteley. I always love to hear from all of you. And this episode has been sponsored by Abnormal Psychology, The Causes and Treatments of Depression, Anxiety and More, a third edition. So this is a great book that goes into depression, anxiety, schizophrenia and lots of other conditions in a great depth. And it looks at these conditions from the biological, cognitive and social standpoint, but then also looks at the different ways how well we can treat them. And it also dives into a bit of the models and different other mental health topics there. So it goes into so much depth about these mental health conditions. And it's all written in a really great, easy to understand way. So like if you really want to understand depression and anxiety and some other mental health conditions, I really do recommend that you get this book. And it also looks at some of the future possible treatments for depression. That's a really interesting section. So I really do recommend this book. So that is Abnormal Psychology, The Causes and Treatments of Depression, Anxiety and More, third edition. Available from all major ebook retailers, and you can order the paperback, last print and hardback version from Amazon, your local bookstore or your local library if you request it. I really do. So that's enough for the personal update. Let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So we're moving on to the content part of today's episode. So we're going to be talking about how do you know if your therapist is a match. And I've already said this is mainly for university psychology students and a clinical psychologist. But anyone will still be able to get lots of great information out of today's episode. So if you've listened to the podcast before, then I have spoken about the importance of the therapeutic alliance and the importance of the client and the therapist clicking or matching. And this relationship is really important to the therapeutic success. And without this matching, the therapy can fail. And this is why this relationship is so, so important, important in a clinical psychology. So thankfully, though, there is about 3 signs that a therapist is a match for their client. But before we move on to the signs, very quickly, I just want to say that this relationship is an extremely powerful predictor of the therapeutic success, regardless of the therapist's style, treatment duration, and other factors. And what those therapist styles are though, all whether that is there stuff like cognitive behavioural therapy, systemic therapy, and all the different therapeutic models. Because as we know, there are a lot. I just can't believe that there's over 500. I would never want to know what all of them are. I think it'd be quite mind-boggling. So let's move on to these signs. So the first sign is, you both agree on a goal. As this podcast is mainly for a clinical psychology audience, we all know that in clinical psychologists, we always have to be collaborative with our clients. And I know that different therapeutic models place different degrees of emphasis on this collaboration. But at the end of the day, the collaboration is still there and it's still really important, which is why we need to work with our clients. But as I always say, because we as clinical psychologists, even though I'm not one, hopefully in the future, we have years of experience in psychology and in the theory, but our clients have experience in it themselves and they are experts in it themselves. No one else has lived their life but them. Therefore, it's really important that we set goals with them and we allow them to call us out when we do something that they don't agree with. And this is the main reason, because if we set goals and the client doesn't agree with them, then they won't care about these goals, meaning that they won't put the work in and the therapy could fail because our clients are not putting in the work because they don't care about these goals. The work feels valuable and effective. And I know there are a lot of different types of therapy, and that's honestly why I love clinical psychology, because it's that there's so many different types and there's so much more to learn, which is why it keeps it fun and interesting. But we need to make sure that our clients know what's happening and that they need to feel like they're spending their time effectively, because too many therapists leave their clients in the dark about their therapy and where they're going, making their clients question their effectiveness and how valuable the therapy is to them. Overall, making it really important to explain what's happening from the start and making the client reflect on these sessions could be a good idea too. Of course, not every session will be mind-blowing. I think we've all been there, even in our lectures at our university. We're always expecting our lectures to be these great, amazing things. Let's face it, most of them aren't. Most of them really aren't that mind-blowing, but we still know that they're important. And because we can see the long term, hopefully, and because we know that these lectures are important for our exams, then we know that we're spending our time effectively and that it's valuable. So it's that sort of comparison. I know I went off on a slight tangent there, and I really hope that allowed you to see where I'm coming from in this point, though. In a point that was to going back to the blog post. of course, not every session will be mind-blowing, but our clients need to feel like they're making progress, at least to some extent each time. And to help this, here are some questions that might be good to ask our clients. Am I gaining new perspectives on my difficulties? Does my therapist and I have a shared understanding of what actions are most important for me? Do I think we are working towards my goals in an effective way? And then the last one is feeling respected and accepted. And if you haven't heard of Carl Rogers, I really do recommend looking him up on Google, getting my clinical psychology book, or basically getting anything you can about him. He's very good. And if memory serves me correctly, I think there's some sort of dispute in the clinical psychology community about how good he is, because some of his ideas are quite controversial. Or maybe that's with the biomedical model. Well, anyway, though, he's a great guy. I make it sound like Oh, I make it sound like I like know him, but his works are very good, and he's definitely one of the most influential figures in psychotherapy, so I really do recommend that you would check him out. But one of his ideas is the unconditional positive regard towards our clients, and this can be applied to because he also came up with the idea of the curiosity paradox, saying that change is easier when we accept ourselves and then we can change. And in much more friendly terms, what he's proposing is that if we make our clients know that we accept them and we respect them, then it makes it easier for them to change, because they don't, then they know that the client isn't coming to us to be changed at the core. Because what they're actually doing is that they're coming to us just so we can help them find better strategies to help them cope with their mental health difficulties, alleviate their psychological distress, and improve their lives. And once our clients know this and we work respectfully with them, then the whole process of a therapy gets a lot easier for everyone. And that's what we want, because we know that our clients, we know that they're not messed up. We know that they're not flawed, they're not deluded, deranged, or any of these other really hurtful, really unhelpful mental health terms. Because we know that, then we know that it's quite easy to respect them, because as a clinical psychologist, so we also know that mental health difficulties, or what they are, is that they're maladaptive strategies to help them cope with everyday life. So yes, you just need to think about it like that. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode, and I really hope that you got something out of it. I know that I definitely did, and I know that this was definitely a really interesting episode for me, so I really hope that you enjoyed it too. And if you know someone who would find today's episode useful, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you wonderful people help spread the word about the podcast. And please check out A Normal Psychology, The Causes and Treatments of Depression, Anxiety and More, a third edition. Available in all of the usual places. I really do recommend that. A great book. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it. If you want to see the show notes, then please go to connorwhiteley.net. And if you want a free 8-book psychology box set, then please go to connorwhiteley.net. Have a great day, and I'll see you next time.